I too was tremendously blessed at Gail's message and how powerful it was, and in only 45 minutes. I just shudder to think of how tremendous it had been had he gone a full hour. Actually, one of the reasons I don't like to speak later in a series like this is because, again, everybody else, and particularly in a book like this, is said everything. And last night I knew I was in trouble when Chuck sat on the verse. That, you know, you never know where he's going to kind of stop and park. And the one thing I was wanted to share was on how Nehemiah was such a different man entirely, simply because he feared God in his life, and it seemed like no one else did. That made him a world apart from everyone else. And then when he spent the evening on it last night, I rushed back to the room, spent till midnight trying to revamp and emphasize some other things. Woke up quite early this morning, going through it again, only then to come in and listen to Raw. And I don't mind anybody being anointed, that's okay. No real problem with that. But then when he stole my text, he was just supposed to go through verse 9. And he went through the whole chapter. And mine is the second half of chapter 6. And when I went and spent the whole thing on such a man as I, and then I'm sitting there watching him go right on through. He read through verse 9, but then he kept right on going through the whole chapter. And I was, what is he doing? And anointing's all right, but stealing verses is sin. You know, and then to have Gail get up, tell Raul if he'd only stayed in verse 14, it'd have been a blessing, which he stole in the first place, and then he re-stole what Raul stole, and the fortunate thing to me, though, is if anybody is going to steal a text from you, I think Raul is the one I'd like to have do it, because of the fact that I can follow right up and do the same message all over again, and the only people that'll know it are the ones that are bilingual. So, anyway... Anyway, chapter 6, verse 10. Afterwards, I came to the son of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Metabeel, who was a secret informer, and he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you." And I said, "Should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go out into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in that way in sin, so that they might have occasion for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these their works, and the prophetess, Nodiah, and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. Let's pray. Father, as we look to your word, we ask that you would open our hearts and teach us. Thank you for your love for us and for the world and for our flocks in particular. We ask, Lord, that in touching us, you would touch many. In teaching us, you'd teach many. In your mercy and grace, when you would draw us close, you would draw many close. We ask now you'd open your word to us, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. I don't know why the only place I'm ever nervous is here. But, anyway. Nehemiah, to me, essentially is a book that, as I look at it, it reminds me, when I first even started reading this, I thought of another book. It's entitled Power Through Prayer, written by a man named E.M. Bounds. Perhaps you've read it. But he makes a statement in that book that to me is so simple and yet so profound. He says, God is not looking for better machinery, but for better men. And of course, that's really always been the issue in history. While so much of the world and even so much of the church is looking for machinery, it's looking for ways to get something done, that has never been of interest to God. He is always looking for ways in which to get it done, first of all, in people. How he carries it out from then on means nothing to him. It's nothing to the economy of God to get the job done. Machinery means nothing. It's always men. And that, to me, essentially is what the book of Nehemiah is all about. It's the story of a better man and how God builds better men and some of the qualities within them. There's a phrase I learned in Bible school years ago. It's simply that the old is in the new contained and the new is in the old explained. It's simply a phrase that says that everything, essentially, there's nothing new in the New Testament almost. It's all prophesied in the Old Testament. And to one who really completely subscribed to the Old Testament, you really almost don't need a New Testament because it's all prophesied there. The whole story of the coming, the birth of the church, mercy, grace, the whole new covenant, it's all laid out. And the New Testament merely records for us that the prophecies of the Old Testament happened. And so the new is in the old contained, but the old is in the new explained. Many of the stories that are in the Old Testament that are wonderful stories are ones that the real meaning comes out almost in full explanation in the sense of New Testament truth. It gets its real focus there. We can go and apply New Testament principles to the Old Testament stories and how wonderfully they fit. On the external, when you look at the Old Testament, and essentially sometimes it appears like it's about nations and kingdoms and countries, cities and walls and temples and nations and tribes, but essentially a closer look at it reveals that it's really a book about people, about men. In the sense that it started with men, and then when it happened with men, God allowed it to happen on the outside in a very graphic, external sort of a way. If there was ever a temple built in the Old Testament, it was built in a man's heart. Then it came into fruition. Whenever there was a great ministry or vision that occurred, it first happened in a man's heart, and then the rivers began to open and the miracles began to happen. Whenever there was a city that was taken and a great amount of geography that happened and it became the city of David, it was because it happened in a man's heart first, and then it followed in life. Nations rose and fell, rivers opened and shut, giants fell, fire came from heaven. Famine started and stopped, and it was all because of the presence, essentially, or the absence of men that God built. First He did it in people, and then He did it through people. But that was always His process. That was always the way that He seemed so wonderfully and so powerfully to work. And the book of Nehemiah is really just such a story. We see, in a sense, the physical world, but it's merely responding in the book of Nehemiah to the spiritual world. The walls occurred physically because they occurred spiritually. The temple appeared physically because, first of all, it was spiritually there within a people's heart, in the leader's heart. Homes were rebuilt. Walls around homes were rebuilt. Finances were restored to people. Families were brought back together. Famines ended. All because, first of all, something happened in a man. Then it happened on the outside. But you always begin, though, all of the stories in the Old Testament with men, essentially. And you begin with men like Nehemiah. Men to me of integrity, men of identity and of insight. That's all we'll be looking at under those three headings, essentially. But men, God always starts it there. I remember one time, very well, over 20 years ago, when I had the privilege of being over in England, and one day, a year over there, but walking with Alan Redpath and being very inquisitive and wanting to find out anything and everything, asking a lot of stupid questions. One time, sometimes asked ones that I got good answers for, and then just Later on, it came back. But I remember one day as I was asking him about ministry and qualities of it, and he turned to me and he told me, he said, "You cannot be a prophet and a promoter. You can be one or you can be the other, but it's impossible to ever be both. Early on in your life, you'll decide which one you're going to be." And it is something that's interesting. The tragic thing is today people are trying to be both oftentimes. They're trying to be with great acts of promotion and undergo many topics and things. But to me, wonderfully, here as I look at Nehemiah, I see a story to me of the identity of what I would think of as a real prophet. One that in the sense of a real, in a sense, man of God, and of looking at him in that sense, because he, first of all, is to me as a man that as I look at him, he's a man of integrity. A man in the sense of his heart and of his life. He was somebody, as Billy Graham says, as he defines integrity, is just simply being in private what you are in public. A man that to me, as I look at Nehemiah, he was the same person through and through, absolutely consistent, no shadow of turning with him, no real variation in him. He was the same in a crowd as he was alone, the same in intensity as he was in quietness. He was the same when all things were pressing down on him as he was when he was at peace. He was somebody that whether he was far away from people or right in the heat of the battle, the man just through the entire book is the same man. But he is. And he was it through and through. And that's a tremendous quality to have. That to me is one of the most coveted and wonderful qualities that anybody can have. And watching Nehemiah, to me it's such a pleasure to read the book and to study it in the light of something like that. There's a way in which you can look at a book like Nehemiah and get right up close to it and go from situation to situation to situation. And then, to me, there's another way you can kind of step back from the whole of the book and look at it, you know, kind of at the whole of the forest, in a sense. Watch him through the processes of the entire thing and seeing him from one skirmish to another, one accusation, one problem, one trial. But as you kind of step back and get a bird's eye view of the man and you watch him as he moves in and through and, you know, the one situation after another, you realize that he was a man that God built. He was a man in a sense like God loves to build. He built many, many before and many after. He was just another in a long line of succession like himself, but they'd all come out of the same factory. They'd all been built in the same sort of a realm. You look at men like Abraham, Joseph, Moses, Joshua, David, Daniel, Elijah, Elisha, John the Baptist, Peter, Paul. As you look at them, you see them in various stages of construction, but they're all men in a sense of just, it's so wonderful to see the process. It's wonderful to see the building because you got men in the end. They're a wonderful example of God building them first. And then the book follows. Then the story, it's just the common consequence. It's the inevitable thing that is going to happen. When you build a man like that and you just set him free, the consequence is going to happen in his life. Men that are surrendered in any environment, any experience, men that are so yielded over to him, it seems like wherever they go, they have a full tank. Plenty on reserve. There's a complete sufficiency and adequacy seemingly for any and every event that seems to hit them. They never struggle in the task. Somehow or another, you know they're prepared for it before it came. It's a wonderful thing to me to watch and study. To me, one of the things that is about the most admirable thing is I love character studies in the Bible. I love just watching them and seeing them. And I tend to just kind of step back and not always look at the individual stories that they're in and out of, but just wanting to look at the person and to learn from it. And to me, when a quality like that gets into a man, it can never be overstated. It can never be one in the sense of underrating the integrity, in the sense of its power, of its authority, of its potential. And to me, when I look over Nehemiah's leadership qualifications, it isn't something that of his wit or of his wisdom so much about him. It isn't so much in the sense of some great adventurous spirit about him that says, well, let's go out and go for it, or his command of people, or his strategy, or his genius. It was just the man. Just the man that he was, in a sense. A man of great consecration. A man of wonderful integrity about him as you look at him. Such a spiritual quality, as I said to me, it's something I just admired. I loved to look at it. And then I loved to almost watch the situations that it's going to move into next. And you always know how it's going to come out. You're not worried for them somehow or another. There's a little suspense, but it's wonderful to watch. when it's something to where somebody in their life, they're more concerned about what happens under their skin than outside of it. That's something to me that's wonderful. In the sense of watching Jesus as he gets into somebody's life, and he loves to make them like Peter when he looks at him and says, you're a piece of sand, but Peter, when I'm through with you, you'll be a rock. I'll make you somebody that what you are through and through. And to me, it's that quality personally that I have always found myself admiring since becoming a Christian in a sense. It's been the thing that has drawn me to people. When I see it, if I don't see it somehow or another, I don't care how well they say something or how well they do it or any other thing. If I don't see it, there's something I'm just personally not all that interested. But when I see it, it's like a magnet to my heart. It's the thing that actually, many years ago, drew me to meet Alan Redpath and to get to know him. I was converted when I was in college, began walking with him, but there was a lot of highs and lows, tremendous waves of inconsistencies in and out, up and down, in a sense. I loved the Lord, and I believed with all my heart he was the Christ, the Son of the living God. That was not up for negotiation, but in a sense, how to perform that which was good, I had no idea of the inconsistencies, the struggles. The time seemed to overwhelm me. At the same time, though, I was constantly being thrown into ministry. Involved with Campus Crusade and thrown onto college campuses and excited about it. I wanted to serve, wanted to testify. Up and down fraternity rows, USC, UCLA, in and out of LA County Jail, sharing, preaching there, Union Rescue Mission, all sorts of experiences, tremendous zeal, and yet without knowledge. At times I'd shared some of my struggles and inconsistencies with people, but for the most part they went unheeded because no one seemed to know. I looked, and there wasn't a rock around. There wasn't a Nehemiah. There wasn't somebody like that. And I remember when I first began to listen and hear Alan Redpath, I was so drawn to him, not because of any one thing that he said, but it was the place from whence he said it. It was an authority when he said it. It was a conviction about it that it rang true, rock solid true. The time he spoke for a week at the church that we were at the time. My father-in-law was chairman of the board of deacons, so he was asked to take him out afterwards. When he out for dinner, and so he called Gene and I, and he said, and he said, "Would you like to join us for dinner with Alan Redpath?" We said, "Sure." And so we came to the restaurant, and they had already been there. And little did I know, before I'd come, he had spent quite a little while telling him what a wonderful son-in-law I had. And I should have been excited about that, I guess. But at any rate, and how he loves the Lord and serving God and out preaching, sharing, ministering all over the place. The wonderful things he was doing under the care of the Board of Deacons off into ministry. And they wanted to send him to seminary and all of these things were going on. And I didn't know any of this had happened. When he came in and sat down, he simply looked over at me and he says, "Well, young man, how are you doing?" I looked at him and I said, "Do you really want to know?" "I'm ready to quit." And he just smiled. Just smiled. He said, "I thought so." Little did I know that as we met later, then he asked me to come over and to join them for a year. But the thing that to me that was so wonderful about it is there was just something from whence he came, from where his heart was at, where his life was at. I found myself saying, "I want that heart." Didn't see it again much until I began to see the same smile in this pulpit. And I began to come around here. One of the things that to me was so wonderful wasn't, the technique that was going on, within the ministry here. It wasn't something that was occurring simply because of the fact that the Calvary Chapel was contemporary, or it understood music, or it was relating to people around, or it had a good strategy, or it found a way to be relevant to the people. All of that somehow or another followed, but it was much more than that. I've seen an awfully lot of relevant contemporary ministries that had all of those traits come and go, rise and fall in the last 20 years. Well, they don't rise and fall because people are contemporary. They rise and fall on men. They rise and fall on hearts. They rise and fall on lives. To me, when I look at it, in Nehemiah, the wonderful quality about it, and there was a consecration, there was a man with integrity. And there was a man about him in a sense that you just look at him and he was a man, he wasn't looking for anything. Wasn't seeking anything. The wonderful thing to me, a man of God, he isn't somebody that's always out looking for a ministry. Looking for some sort of, you know, gimmick or gadget, something flashy in a sense, something, you know, contemporary out there. No, a man of integrity isn't looking for anything. Doesn't need a gadget, doesn't need a gimmick, doesn't need it at all. It means nothing to him. It's amazing to me on how many ministries are looking for that. Gadgets, gimmicks, something that's going to relate. What is it that the people need to know and hear? How true it is, does it work, doesn't really seem to make much difference. Remember, in going through college, had a number of business law courses, and the interesting thing to me is, in business law, it's considered absolute fraud. Absolute fraud for a company to represent a product, to be one thing knowing that it isn't always that. Absolute fraud in a sense, and there's no corporate shield, there's no legal structure which a man can hide behind if they find that fraudulently he in his own heart knows it isn't always the case. And he represents it to be so, you can sue him for everything he's got. Even our carnal world of its weak integrity looks and says, that's rotten and wrong to the core for somebody to do that. However, in the ministry world, oftentimes somebody says, well, our product works 50% of the time. We only have a 50% mortality rate. We're so happy with it. Even Mattel Toys pulls something off the rack if 0.5% to 1% get hurt with it. Amazing how many gadgets and gimmicks are going on in the ministry. If somebody has a truth, it's always the truth. It never varies. It works in every century, generation, kindred, tribe, and tongue. You can take it everywhere in the world, and it's absolutely true every time. Every time. In the church today, if it even gets something 50, 60%, look at this, let's market it. What's going on? We're in trouble. No, a man of integrity is never looking for a ministry. He's simply exercising the one he's already got. He's simply letting it go. That's Nehemiah. In a sense, as you look at him, to me, he's just a wonderful character to study. He's just a wonderful man to see. He's a man that when he walks into a room, there's a power about him, an authority about him, and overshadows and outshines everyone else around. Because the man was what he said. So it's wonderful. We've all heard the expression, what you are speaks so loud I can't hear what you're saying. But oh, how powerful it is when what you are and what you say are the same. Now that's something wonderful. Somebody somewhere, I don't know who, just found it in my notes one time. And it was too good for me to have thought of it. But at any rate, one said that there's only two types of men in the ministry. Only two types, I mean, in the sense of Christian ministry. They both say the same sort of a thing. They both have the same ministry. And at the first hearing, you really can't tell the difference between the two. But as you begin to listen to the two, one of them, what he says is true, his theology is just fine, but at the same time, somehow or another, you know, personally, it isn't real in his own heart. And the message is one that simply goes over his head. It's true. But then there's another man. Then what he says is something that when he says it, you sense it went right into him at the gut level. It turned him upside down. It absolutely flayed his heart. It revolutionized his being in the inside and the core out. And at that man, it comes out with power. They both say the same thing. One of them knows it. The other one thinks it. Nehemiah was such a man. Not a man working for a victory as he finds himself going through the book. He wasn't working for it. He was working from it. There's a great difference between that. Many times I see men in the ministry, you sense they're working for something. If only all these things line up and it happen and occur, we will arrive, we will be someplace, but not so a man like Nehemiah. He operates from victory. He's already got it. He's not working for rest. He's working from it. There's all the difference in the world between the two. Not the same at all. Such a man like Nehemiah, no weapon that is formed against him. In all of the weapons that were shot at him, it was something you knew even before he walked in. A man so enarmored this way, so dressed with this, so clothed with the integrity and the aspects of his life. He wasn't open. He wasn't vulnerable. There wasn't a place that, oh, if they get him here, they've got him. No.
Shot after shot, accusation after accusation, rumor after rumor, attack after attack. Nehemiah, any side, any angle, any speed, he doesn't flinch. It's wonderful to me to watch. Never panicked. Back was never to the wall. In a sense, he's somebody to me as I really look at him and with the others around it. I don't care how many of the prophets and letters were going around and rumors were going about, you know, about him and all of the other things that were there. He was a man, he was above it all. He was in a different world, a different realm from whence he came. It had already been settled before the book was written. It's already there. It's wonderful to me to see. It makes me think of Magic Johnson in a junior high basketball game. I mean, it's a different, he's a different league. He's somebody that he's just there. You're wondering, and in a sense, you know, he was so different. These poor little guys like Sanballat and Tobiah and all of the others, so outclassed. So different all the way through. It wasn't fair from the start. It was a setup all the way through, not by these guys, but from God. He already won long before he just came to pick up the trophy in the book. That's all it's about. I don't blame Sanballat and Tobiah. They were just merely creatures of their own world. Men of their own environment. They were for sale, so they just assumed that Nehemiah would be too. They were driven by the fears and natural fears of men. Certainly he will be too. They would negotiate. Everything in life is negotiable. Certainly he would be too. They said, let's negotiate. Nehemiah said, no. Let's infuriate, sorry. Let's deviate. Staying on the same course. Let's retaliate, forget it. Let's mutilate. Take your best shot. I thought all those myself, wasn't it pretty good? But anyway, he could look back at them and say, because I'm going to annihilate. That one just came. Right there. But he looked at this whole thing, in a sense, and it finally is built through six chapters in such a way, and they keep on shooting, they keep on talking, because that is exactly how I felt. There was no question about it. To me, God would see you be so wise, he would be so intelligent, he would see me so good, all of his power and mercy and everything would come to full fruition, full adequacy, if he would only make 2 Billy Grahams and none of me. I love that. At that time in my life, if such an offer was there, I'd have taken it in a flash. I'd have taken it without a second thought. I would have taken it all with heaven in mind and the best of everything, you know, is the good thing. And throughout life, and many times, you know, whether it's gone on to where the temptation is where God's had to come to me, and when I find myself wishing there's 2 Chuck Smiths, 2 Alan Redpaths, or 2 somebody else, and God having to say, wait a minute, we talked about that one. That was all God sent me to Kansas City for, was to hear that. I wrote a letter home to Jean. Told her I would still have that letter. Say, my life has changed. And following men. I need to be like them. Sin. It was so obvious to me, though, why God made them. And the faintest why he had made me. And the faintest. To me, I was just like an uncoordinated sort of a kid sitting at a piano bench, though, but listening to a Van Cliburn and just dreaming of playing and of him just moving my fingers, you know, across the keys like him when I didn't nor still know where middle C is. Make 2 Van Cliburns. Make 2 that would play music for heaven like he plays. I wanted 2 of them, none of me. It took me a while to realize that what I loved was the instrument that they played, and only because they had given a lifetime to learn to play it well. In the sense of their own heart, when I looked, I wasn't there for the years that Billy Graham was in production, and when he was in the factory in the early stages. I was there when he came out, you know, the end of the line sort of a thing, when Alan Redpath came out the end of the line. I came along after Chuck Smith, 20 years of going through as an evangelist, trying to drive people as God's putting him through. And then I see him when he comes, I say, oh, hey, 2 of those. Realizing men all unto themselves, God made them. His glory. And there was something where God wanted to come and say, what you love isn't that person, isn't their ministry, it's the fact that they have learned to sit in the seat that I have given them. And they do it with integrity. And they do it with identity. They know what they are in my eyes and what I want to do in them. I found myself looking and saying, well, then God be about that business with me. I found myself struggling with that concept many times. And I'm not over the struggle by any means at all. In a sense, there is something where many times I've wanted to go back and say, wait a minute. I want to be like somebody else. Particularly, I was tempted again when I came on staff here. And, watching Chuck. Here on Saturday night, come out of the concert, it's a packed house. Phenomenal things going on Sunday night again as Chuck taught, a packed house. Monday night, Chuck taught, and again, just jams, of people were out. Tuesday night was kind of a midweek concert. People out, evangelism, people getting saved in a drove Saturday nights, Tuesday nights. Wednesday night was Bible school. Thursday night again, Chuck taught, packed house. Friday night I taught. So funny, you know what I mean? People thought, well, Friday night must be when they hold funeral services here. Everybody at the time felt sorry for me. I taught a Bible study in one of the family's homes here at church, and Chuck Girard, and a number of children of the day came to that one, and they'd come once in a while on Friday night and say, and they came in the office and said, Don, really, we like what you said. We could really help you out. We could probably get some people there. Be nice if somebody heard it, and things. It's a fine study, but they used to come and encourage me. They said, we'll pray. Peter Jacobs, children of the day, came and said, we'll play. We'll help you out. Really, we'd love to. We believe in resurrections, something. But the thing is that it was one of those things that I found myself struggling. I went to Chuck and told him of what was happening and the offers that were there. About 300 people. That was a nice group, but not compared to anything else. Nothing like it. Here. But as I went to Chuck with it, and I asked him what had happened and what they'd offered, and said, what do you think? And he asked me, he says, well, what do you think? I said, well, I think we have a concert Saturday night. I think we have one Tuesday night. And I think God has just called me to teach. He said, then do it. Even though I knew I was cutting my own throat. In a sense, there was just an opportunity where somebody says, here, we can add another mantle. We can help pull this thing off. And of course, that type of a pressure of looking over, I don't know that it ever ends through the ministry. I find myself today admiring and coveting qualities and ones that I never dreamed I would have. Like Greg Laurie. A sense of looking at him years younger than me. But yet at the same time watching, and here I'm out in the Inland Empire where all your smog goes at the end of the day. But it's something where, and out there at the fringes of it, you're heading out towards the desert, but in the heart of it, in the Inland Empire, there Greg is in harvest. I've watched through the years and become one of the most tremendous communicators I've ever heard. Listened to him again Monday night and just sat listening. There's nobody in the history of San Bernardino County or the Inland Empire that has led more people to Christ in all of its history. Not one near the fruit of that ministry. Nothing like it. It's phenomenal. And I listen, and something that starts to come up to say, try it. Wonder why, secretly in a sense, why Chuck didn't ask me to preach at the Harvest Festival. Coming up here and, sort of a thing. Why, Greg, I would never say that out loud, of course, sort of a thing. I know if I said it home, my wife would look at me and say, you mean you really wonder? He's trying to lead people to Jesus. That's why. Not trying to hold a mass clinic for the cure of insomnia. He's trying to lead people to Christ. That's not your ministry. Somebody else's. Stay away. I can look at a Gail Irwin and after and just watching and flowing, and he has me in the palm of his hand through a message. So much so at the end, I want to go buy suspenders. You know, in the sense sort of a thing. I hate suspenders. Listen to Raul Ruiz. It's powerful. I've never known what he said, but it's powerful. And you stop to think of how many Mexicans are not worshiping Mary or fornicating today just because of him. Those are the only two things I've ever gotten out of his ministry for sure. Don't worship Mary and don't fornicate. And it's amazing how many are. That true? I look at Mike McIntosh, and it used to bother me. I didn't know exactly who he was and where he was and where he would come and going. But then when I found out he didn't know either, then it was a little okay. But in the sense of watching things happen. Where I was part of the same sort of a sibling group of all of this and watching things go off into the world beyond, you know, dreams to see what it is. And then only to watch him come home as the way the wonderful ability and gift that God has given him of just taking people under his arm and loving them and helping them. This last year as he took my son, and thank he and Sandy, for the rest of my life for that act alone, transforming his heart. Larry Pelletier and Miles and Leo down there, watching it happen. How powerful. How wonderful. But still being able to sit there and say, God, what do you want with me? And staying wherever it is that it is at. That's what I see in Nehemiah. A man that in a sense, he just knew who he was. He knew his identity. He knew his call. He didn't have to vary from it. He could spend a lifetime this way. Years, 12 years, and watch the whole thing and never a chink in his armor. Man of integrity. A man of identity. Jesus looked at the Pharisees. And he says, you judge yourselves by one another. Such a thing is an abomination to God. He looks and he says, you try to be like each other. Outside of Christ and in the world, everybody is sort of that way in one sense, and it's sin, but inside the body of Christ, it's an abomination. He looks at his servants and he says, look at me. Look at who I am. What have I called you to do and be? Sit in my presence. Let it be formed. It'll take years. But what's formed will never fail. It will outlive it all. It will be powerful, it will be deep, it will be wonderful. And when we can just simply get our eyes off of anything and everybody else, bless God with all of our heart for who they are. Thank God that they're part of His orchestra, and we maybe play an instrument over here that's doesn't have, we're not first fiddle or first seed of this or that, and we play off someplace else, and our instrument isn't that profound to us. Whatever it is He called us to it. Do it with all our heart in one day. See what it is that He will do. Because such a man like that doesn't only have integrity and identity, he has insight. It says there about him, he says, then I perceived. As something was coming around his way, as something was happening, he could just simply look at it. The perception was there. Rest was maintained. I think one of the things watching in the last 20 years, all of these different ministries coming and going, rising and falling, all the chaos and the attacks, and so many of them getting shot down by one thing or another in it. And yet, one of the things that I have admired, more almost than anything that Chuck said, is just smile. The same. In season, out of season. Never panic. Seems to have a perception of what it is that's going on. Seems to see it at a distance. Seems to watch it coming and have the comfort to know it will soon go. Men like this, they outlive all the trials. Outlive them all. Just as the Lord told Habakkuk. And Habakkuk was saying, how long, God, until you deal with this, until this thing is over. And God says, oh, it won't be long, Nehemiah. He says, see, I'm already prepared. See, the series, they're going to come down all roaring lion. They're going to swoop down like an eagle on prey. They'll pick you guys up. They'll drag you into this. Next thing you know, anyway, wait a minute, God. Hold. And Habakkuk says, how can you use one less righteous than me? All right. We got a problem. He wanted judgment. Now he's getting it. He says, all right, we got a problem, but how can you use one such as them? And then God tells Habakkuk, he says, Habakkuk, go sit down. Quiet down. Wait. When you're quiet, I'll talk to you. So he went up. He says, watch. Wisely enough to say, I'll wait until he rebukes me. He knew he was wrong. Though his heart told him it was wrong, his mind, he didn't understand it yet. But then when finally the message came, God simply told him, he says, Habakkuk, I want to tell you something. The just shall live. You'll outlive them all. You'll outlive every one of your tribes. You will outlive them all because of the faith that's in me, because of the trust. You have it, the just, you will live. Don't worry. You will come through this thing richer and deeper and stronger than ever. All of your trials, you'll outlive them. They all come and they all go. And as he looks there at the Assyrians, they come and they go. The Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Jezurites, the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Philistines, the Termites, they all come. They all go. He says, you'll outlive them all. Have you had lunch with a Hittite lately? They were powerful once. Babylonian? God used them. They were powerful at the time. They seemed to sweep down, make prey of the children of Israel. But when God was through with them, they lived. And those that weren't just, when somebody looks and says, God, make me just. Make me the man, the woman of God you want me to be. May my life be a discovery of you. Discovering daily God's great love for me. Such mercy, forgiveness, amazingly free. Discovering daily what grace really means. Unmerited favor beyond all my dreams. Discovering daily, each day at its start, that all that I need, he'll freely impart. Discovering daily that God really cares. Thanking him daily, he does answer prayer. Discovering daily Christ speaking to me. He speaks through the Bible, once blind, now I see. Discovering daily, each day that I live, that all that I need, he'll always give. Discovering daily I can't, but he can. Thanking him daily for my place in his plan. Delighting and basking in love so divine. Secure in the knowledge I'm his and he's mine. Besides mere contentment, excitement I see of the daily adventure of Christ alive and living in me. I want to close with a song. And Mark, if you'll come up, I'm going to have him play. But it's in your hymnal in front of you there, Holy, Holy, Holy. Number 31, but to me our eyes. Pardon? 31 in the hymnal, but they're to be set on him, not men. Swallowed up in him, surrendered over to him, and just say, Lord, be who you are in me, for thou alone art holy. Mark is going to play it through. A few times, you'll know why I've asked him to do it alone in a moment, but then we'll all join in. But let's listen. Thank you.
south this place. Forgive us that we look to others. We thank you for them. Our life has been enriched wonderfully by them. But Lord, set our eyes on Jesus. And may we be men and women who, when we stand before them, represent you in your words. In your precious name, Jesus.
This is the end of Side 2 and the end of this message. If you would like further information, please write to Chapel Tapes. The address is P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. Or call our toll-free lines. If you're calling outside of California, the number is 1-800-272-WORD. For those calling inside California, the number is 1-800-282-WORD. May God richly bless you as you continue to study His Word.